opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Wake up, America, with your host, Tina Volpe. Did you know that what's discussed on the program today could affect your health for the rest of your life? Get ready to take notes in the next hour, and we'll want you to participate, too. Now, here's your host, Tina Volpe.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for being here with us. I'm Tina Volpe, as you just heard, and this is Wake Up America. This is your wake-up call. I'm also the author of The Fast Food Craze and the new book that I've just authored with Judy Carman, The Missing Piece, will be out this spring. So I'm pretty excited about that. It's very exciting. And we have a very special guest with us today, and I've been reading his book. It's Gary Francione, and he's an American legal scholar and a distinguished professor of law, among many other things. I mean, I'm not going to go into the whole bio, but he's also the author of several books. And the newest one is titled Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation, which is an amazing book, and I really thank you, Gary, for being here. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Tina.
I'm really happy to have you. I have so many questions for you. This abolitionist approach is so serious, so moving, and so important that we really need to cover a lot of this and your views, because I think your views are important. But first, let's start with something a little personal, if you don't mind.
Well, I guess.
You don't mind personal stuff, do you?
Well, I don't know. You go ahead and ask, and I'll tell you.
the awakening. It's my thing to find out how people, because, you know, the second book I wrote, The Missing Piece, is all about awakenings and transformations, and it's all personal stories.
Uh-huh.
My curiosity is always with, where did you start? How did you start? What woke you up to become an animal rights person, or to understand that we shouldn't be killing animals?
Well, you know, it came late in my life because I never had any animals growing up. We, you know, my brother had pretty serious allergies, and we never had any, you know, any pets. My father was in the restaurant business, and for a while was involved in the meat industry, in that he used to go around and purchase meat for various butcher shops. This was not really an issue that. I didn't think about it at all, actually. To be frank with you, when I was growing up, I never thought about this issue at all. It's not that I disliked animals or ever, you know, was personally abusive to them. It's just I never interacted with them, really, and never thought about this issue. When I was in law school, I visited a slaughterhouse. A friend of mine who was a vegetarian raised this issue with me and engaged me in discussion about it. And I visited a slaughterhouse while I was in law school, and it troubled me greatly. And I stopped eating meat immediately. I stopped eating cows and chickens and pigs. And I continued to eat sea animals for about, I think, another year or so until I read something about how they, too, were sentient. I didn't really know very much about animals, and I read something about fish and other sea animals, and I decided to stop eating them. And then as I learned more a couple years later, I became a vegan, and that was about 26 or 27 years ago. When I was confronted with the fact that there really was no difference between eating meat and eating dairy and eggs, it's all the same stuff. So I stopped eating at all. And that was, as I said, 26 or 27 years ago. But it's interesting because, as I said, you know, I never had an animal growing up, so I never really interacted with them, and I didn't really know very much about animals. Before I got, you know, when we got the first dog that Anna Charlton and I got together as a couple, it was the first dog I ever had in my life, and I had already been a vegetarian then for maybe a year or so. And having a dog in the house and interacting with a dog was just remarkable because, you know, I learned, wow, my Lord, these, you know, non-human animals are so much like us, it's scary.
You don't even
have to get to the non-human primate stage. You know, dogs are so much like us. And so, you know, and I, But as I said, you know, originally it started with my going to a slaughterhouse and sort of seeing the violence of a slaughterhouse. Actually, the first slaughterhouse I visited was a veal. It was a place that produced veal, and it was dreadful. It was absolutely dreadful. I've seen a number of slaughterhouses over the years, and I've seen egg batteries, and I've seen dairy farms, and I've seen supposedly free-range and supposedly cage-free facilities, and I've seen all of this stuff, and actually, it's all horrible. But I still, in periods of stress in my life, I still have nightmares going back to that first slaughterhouse that I visited. It, you know, they're all horrible, and that one, in many ways, was no more or less horrible than the other slaughterhouses I've visited. Yeah. But it made an incredible impression on me.
It was that first impression, first of all, I think.
Yeah, sure.
And the fact that they were babies.
Yeah, well, you know, it was, yeah, yes and no. I mean, because I've always, you know, I don't really have much, I mean, I find, you know, the campaign to sort of stop people from eating veal, I think, is ridiculous. I mean, you know, who cares? I mean, you know, it's, what's the difference between, you know, a veal calf and a cow? I mean, you know, I just don't see that. And I don't favor encouraging people to believe that there's a moral distinction between baby animals and non-baby animals. I mean, it's all dreadful.
It is.
But I do remember that first slaughterhouse I visited, seeing animals that were shackled and hoisted and supposedly unconscious, and they were and many of them were conscious when they were being cut into because they weren't stunned properly so that they didn't stay completely unconscious during the slaughtering process. But that's typical. I mean, I've seen that in a number of slaughterhouses I've been in over the years, animals that are supposedly unconscious at the moment of the cutting, of the butchering process, they're not at all unconscious. They're moving around.
Not right, Gary. That's just absolutely not right. So what really troubles me, and what I really, really wonder about a lot, is how come there are people that it affects so profoundly and so immediately, like you and I. I mean, I had that same kind of an experience at a lot younger age, but why is it that some people can actually work there and still continue to eat meat? How is it that some people are reached and some people aren't? This is such a big question to me. I really think that 80% at least of the population, if they were to visit a slaughterhouse or see what you saw, don't you think that they would feel the same way we do?
Well, you know, I think a lot of them would. I don't know that I would want to attach a specific number to it, but I certainly think... I think most people really are ignorant of the way that their food is produced, and they're intentionally ignorant. They want to, they know there's something wrong. They don't want to learn about the process, and so I think that that's true. I mean, I think that many people if many people saw the way that their food was produced, I think many of them would reconsider what they should be, what and how they should be eating. As far as the people who work in slaughterhouses are concerned, you know, they are, for the most part, a pretty sad lot of people, because many of them are immigrants, and many of them are illegal immigrants, and many of them are people who are borderline mentally disabled. Nobody works in a slaughterhouse if they can get another job. I mean, unless they're tremendously mentally disturbed. Nobody works in the slaughterhouse who can get another job. They're dreadful. I mean, it has the highest turnover of any industry in the United States. There's a lot of injury. They're very depressing places to work. They're places that, they're a fairly sad group of people. And I think for the most part, there are people who sort of have to be, in those positions. I'm not sure that there are a lot of people, particularly who work on the actual slaughtering line, who do so because, you know, they think it's a good job or whatever.
Oh.
Most of them don't think that way.
And
but,
I think they have a lot of alcoholics in that.
Right, exactly. Now, one of the things that's really troubling to me is the fact that, and this is something I discuss and have been discussing for some years now, but it's a major topic of in my book, Animals as Persons, that you mentioned before. One of the things that troubles me is that the modern animal, I don't want to call it an animal rights movement because it doesn't really have much to do with animal rights, but the modern animal movement, whatever you want to call it, and by this I mean most of the large national organizations, certainly in the United States and many of them in Europe as well, and elsewhere in South America, are promoting this idea that really what we should be doing is making animal products more humane. And first of all, I don't think that works. But secondly, I think that I don't think that these these supposed improvements are making the process in significantly better in any way. But I think the effect that it's having is making people feel more comfortable about consuming animal products.
Yes.
And that troubles me because yes, if people saw the way that animal products were produced, they would reconsider how and what they eat. But when they have large organizations, when they have, you know, HSUS and PETA and Farm Sanctuary and everybody else telling them, oh, well, you know, you can do something morally good by, you know, if you're in Canada, go to Kentucky Fried Chicken and eat their chicken because their chicken is gassed rather than stunned in whatever, however the chicken is killed here in the United States. Or, you know, you have HSUS and other groups promoting things like Proposition 2 and you know, telling people that, well, you know, animals in California are going to be significantly better off. What that tells people is that they can continue to eat animal products. It's only a matter of making sure that you get the humanely produced one.
Yeah, but wait a minute. I agree with you there.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many people. My neighbors who are hunters are never going to go vegan, Gary. I mean, I hate to say the word never.
Yeah.
But let me tell you something. They are my closest neighbors, and I have been working on them for almost 5 years.
Uh-huh.
Every time they sit down at dinner at my table, I'm like, and my kids, everybody says, oh, look, we're eating a meal. No animal suffered. You know, we've made it such a huge deal that veganism is a delicious way to live and a way to lay your head on the pillow where you're not, you didn't cause any suffering. What about these people? These people aren't going to change. And there's so many people that aren't going to change.
There's always going to be some people who aren't going to change. And you know, the issue is, do you pitch the movement to those people who aren't going to change? And if, I mean, I don't have any reason to believe that people who don't give a darn about this issue at all are going to buy cage-free eggs or indeed anything else which is even marginally more expensive. I mean, why do we think that people who don't care are going to even take that step? Number one. Number two, and let me just say, you're never going to have a situation where you're going to be able to completely change the market, because even if you were, you know, for example, in California, Proposition 2 doesn't even come into effect, I think, until, what, 2015 or something like that? I mean,
we got to take a real quick break.
Okay, go ahead.
We'll get back to this Prop 2 issue because I really want to discuss that with you as well.
Okay.
You guys stay with us.
A healthy dialogue for your lifestyle. Voice America Health and Wellness.
The Missing Piece, that's P-E-A-C-E, focuses on the spiritual and compassionate transformation that takes place within when reverence for all life is the focus. We show through every personal story in no uncertain terms that an awakening takes place in the love energy of people who refrain from doing harm to any living thing. The stories in The Missing Piece will make you laugh and cry, and we're sure you'll even find little parts of yourself within them, but they will most certainly change your life. You'll see things a little differently for reading them, and we'll find that all of this time, what you've been looking for is right here in The Missing Piece. Take this journey and you won't ever want to turn back. Look for release in the spring of 2009, and to learn more, go to dreamriverpress.com. That's dreamriverpress.com. What does it take to have a healthy, happy relationship? A marriage that lasts forever? In today's society, does anyone really have the right answers? Just look at the tabloids and you'll see that the fairy tale relationships are missing the key elements of happily ever after. Dr. Terry Orbuck, also known as the Love Doctor, brings you not only the most current findings, but experts on sex, friendship, parenting, marriage, divorce, love, and work relationships. Dr. Terry gives you realistic tips and advice and the research to back it up. The Love Doctor airs live bright and early Monday mornings at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. on the East Coast on the Voice America channel. Listen up, America. The doctor is in. Every week, Body Talk is here to answer your pressing questions about the fields of traditional, alternative, and functional medical science. Join hosts Dr. Stephen Ross and Drake Killis as they uncover the truth behind some of today's ailments, symptoms, and diseases. You'll get the most up-to-date information on treatments and remedies and their effectiveness. Plus, you'll hear from leading experts on a variety of health topics. Listen for Body Talk with Dr. Stephen Ross and Drake Killis, Tuesdays at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern on the Voice America Health and Wellness Network.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Listening to Wake Up America with your host, Tina Volpe. To participate in today's discussion, please call us toll-free in North America at 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You can also comment or question via email at books@fastfoodcraze.com. Now, back to Tina.
Hey, welcome back. We're talking with Gary Francione, and we were discussing Prop 2 in California, which just passed. Hi, Gary. Welcome back.
Hi. Thank you, Tina.
And I understand that Prop 2 is not even going into effect until 2015 or something.
Right. It's not even going to into effect until 2015, if it ever goes into effect, because there's, you know, this it may never go into effect. But it's not going to go into effect until 2015. Number one. Number two, the changes that it requires are really quite minimal changes. I mean, they're really quite minimal changes, and they're changes that industry is in the process of making anyway, because those changes are cost efficient. They actually increase the efficiency of animal production. They actually, in many cases, they will actually increase producer profits. But what's really disturbing to me is animals are still going to be tortured. Even if these things come into effect in 2015,
right,
animals are still going to be tortured. Only the torture is going to have the stamp of approval of HSUS and Farm Sanctuary and all the other groups that are on board on, you know, for this sort of thing. And that encourages people to believe that they can continue to consume animals, and they can do so in a humane way, in a morally acceptable way. And I think that that notion is absolutely counterproductive,
you know,
to our making any progress.
I agree, but you know, I had Wayne Pacelli on not too long ago, and I asked him point blank. I said, Wayne, listen, you're in the welfare movement. You're trying to change lives and awaken people. But how come? Let me just ask you this: how come the production of animals and the killing of animals and the consumption of animals goes up every year? If you think this welfare approach is working? And he came back and said, you know what his reply was, is that there are more people being born and more people.
Oh, that's nonsense. I mean, look, Tina, we've had animal welfare. And let me just say, I know Wayne very well. And I know, you know, I'm not suggesting that Wayne isn't sincere or Ingrid's not sincere. That's not the point. I'm not making any moral judgments about individuals. I just think the strategy is counterproductive. But we have had animal welfare, you know, it didn't drop out of the sky last week.
No.
We've had it for 200 years now, and we are using more animals now in more horrific ways than at any point in human history.
That was my point, is that welfare isn't working, obviously, if we're still killing more animals and people are eating more animals. And regardless, you're right, I think these people are all sincere. They truly love animals. I just don't understand why it's not working.
Why they embrace welfare is clear, because even though they are sincere, the problem is when you're running HSUS, the last time I looked at their financials online, they are sitting on top of almost $250 million. You know, people who run these organizations are making lots and lots of money, and these organizations bring in lots and lots of money. And the more moderate they are, the broader they appeal to people, and the more they bring in. So they have a vested interest in basically not promoting anything that is too terribly that requires too much of a life change, because that may cut down on their contributions. But I mean, you know, look, I don't know where anybody gets the idea that animal welfare is going to lead to anything but more consumption, because that is the theory of animal welfare. The theory of animal welfare is the consumption of animals is not per se morally objectionable. The thing that's morally objectionable is the way in which animals are raised and treated and slaughtered. And that if we can clean that up and improve that, then we're doing something morally good. And that idea just perpetuates and increases production and consumption of animals. I mean, I saw something recently that the demand for cage-free eggs in the United Kingdom is increasing dramatically, and people are consuming more eggs because they can now get eggs that they say are being produced humanely. I mean, think about this. You know, there are literally thousands of stories on the internet about people who were once vegetarian or vegan who are now going back to eating animal products because they feel better about it. Because they're being told by groups like HSUS and PETA and Farm Sanctuary and all of these groups, they're being told you can consume animal products and feel good about it. And I think that's crazy. I mean, you know, that's not going to get us to a vegan world, Tina.
But what about all the people that aren't going to go vegan? And what about the animal rights movement or the animal welfare movement bringing some kind of clarity and some kind of information to people who are completely in the dark?
Well, first of all, do we want to have a movement, you know, that is geared toward this amorphous group of people who are never going to change? I mean, first of all, people who don't care about this issue don't care about the issue. And I don't know why anybody thinks animal welfare is going to make them care about the issue, number one. Number two, how about all the people out there that we could reach? How about all of the people out there who would be more inclined to go vegan if they had a clear moral message to grasp onto. I mean, think about it. If you care about this issue, let's assume you're one of the people who does care about the issue, and you're really confused and you're struggling with it. If you've got major animal, you know, hero-type people, if you have, you know, these various large organizations and these various animal personalities telling you, you can satisfy your moral obligations by eating cage-free eggs. You know what's going to happen? You're going to eat cage-free eggs. You're not going to stop eating eggs. And I will tell you something, having seen cage-free facilities, anybody out there who thinks that there's a significant difference between a battery egg and a cage-free egg probably also believes that a weight-challenged person comes down their chimney at Christmas time and puts things in their stockings. Because there's really no difference between a cage-free egg and a battery egg, except a cage-free egg is one big cage.
Right, and they're all crammed together.
That's right.
It's just as bad, if not worse. Well, no, it's not just as bad as battery eggs.
And look, Tina, the bottom line is, you know, we've all got limited time and limited resources. So if tomorrow I'm going to spend some time talking to kids at a community college or some other venue, I can either spend my time saying, don't, you know, eat cage-free eggs, or I can explain to them why they shouldn't be eating eggs at all. I can't do both. And by encouraging them to eat cage-free eggs, I'm encouraging them to continue exploiting animals. I'm much better off spending my time explaining to them why they shouldn't be eating eggs at all.
Absolutely.
And so this is one of my arguments is you've got a movement that is spending all of this money on encouraging people to go to Kentucky Fried Chicken in Canada and make sure they get their gas chicken, or eat cage-free eggs, or go to Whole Foods and get their humanely raised beef products or whatever. We should be promoting a very clear, unequivocal message that we have no moral justification in eating or using animals at all, and that we ought to stop it altogether.
I agree.
And instead of encouraging, I mean, you know, there are all sorts of things that we could be doing. You know, I was mentioning to you in the break that I had recently visited a Whole Foods store that I hadn't been in a couple of years. So it was in New Jersey. It was in southern New Jersey, and I hadn't been in there that particular store for a while. And they are now selling far more meat than, I mean, the last time I was in there, they had like two cases of fresh meat. Now they've got, 10 or 12. I mean, they have a lot more. They're selling a lot more fresh meat, and they have all of these signs up talking about how these animals are humanely raised. And I made a comment to one of the young people who works behind the meat counter, who pointed out to me, and I get this from Whole Foods employees all the time, they point out to me that PETA gave them an award for being the most for being the most important or the best retailer of, you know, humanely raised meat products. So now what you have is you have organizations like PETA that are actually actively promoting and facilitating the sale of meat products. I think this is really counterproductive. Again, I'm sure Ingrid thinks she's doing the right thing. That's not the point. The point is, I think that the strategy is counterproductive, and I think it's wrong.
Yep, I do. You're talking about moral schizophrenia in your book when it comes to animals. Which is what you're talking about here. People cannot need to get a moral message.
Yeah, I mean, look, most people, you've got to present a simple message to people. When things get too complicated, people, I mean, that's really the problem in many ways. The problem really is you want to present something really simple to them. And what I find, is, despite that I'm always being told by the welfarists that people aren't ready for the more radical message, I disagree with that. I spend a lot of my time doing shows like this and going to universities. In my day job, I'm a professor of law and philosophy at Rutgers University, and I spend a lot of time going around to different universities and talking to young people and community colleges and various other sorts of venues and speaking with students. And what I find most of the time is, you give me somebody who doesn't know really very much about the issue at all, and I start talking to that person. If that person cares at all about animals, you give me a half an hour with that person, I'll get that person thinking seriously about whether or not she or he should pursue a vegan lifestyle. Now, they might not do it immediately. And one of the things that I always, I'm always asked by folks, well, what if I agree with you, but I don't want to go vegan, or I can't go vegan immediately. I always tell people, of course you can go vegan immediately. It's not like it was, 25 years ago when I became vegan. It was much more difficult back then. It's really quite easy now, particularly in places like the U.S. But what I always tell them is, look, there are things that you can do. Like, you can go vegan in stages. You can go vegan for breakfast and try that for a couple of weeks, and then you can try go vegan for lunch and try that for a couple of weeks, and then go vegan for dinner, and lo and behold, in 2 or 3 months, you're vegan. I never tell them that they should go and eat cage-free eggs or free-range this or humanely raised that, because I think that that's just encouraging them to believe that they can continue to consume animals and do so, and they can pat themselves morally on the back while they're doing it. And the problem is, that is exactly what the modern movement is doing, is it's making people feel good about exploiting animals. How can that make sense, Tina? How can that make sense? How can Proposition 2 make any sense at all? Think about all the money that HSUS spent on that campaign. If HSUS had spent that money on vegan education, if they put all of that money into vegan education in California alone, they would have probably created a couple thousand more vegans. And you know what? In the end, that's a much more significant achievement than Proposition 2, which is not even going to come into effect until 2015 and is presently making people feel as though animals in California have a great deal. Let's move them all out to California. They're all dying to be in California because it's such a great place for animals. That is
insane. It is.
That's bad. That's very sad.
No, but see, I always look at the other side of the coin.
What is the other side of the coin?
I know. We shouldn't be killing animals. They still end up at the slaughterhouse. They still end up hanging by one leg and their neck split half alive or half awake. The point is that when I think about the people that I know that are such huge meat eaters that are never going to listen to anything I say or anyone else says, these Oprah shows with the little welfare things somehow puts a light in their head to say, oh, my God, animals aren't treated properly.
If they think that the answer is to just make sure that they're buying humanely raised animals, then what they're going to do is they're going to go to the store and they're going to buy their cage-free eggs, or they're going to buy their humanely raised meat or whatever. And first of all, I really think that if you see the way animals are raised, there isn't a heck of a lot of difference between the humanely raised animal and the conventionally raised animal. There really is very, very little difference. And so I really just don't think that there is a great deal of difference. But I think that if somebody either cares about the issue or doesn't, and if somebody cares about the issue, we ought to be educating them about why they should not be exploiting animals. If somebody doesn't care about the issue, why are we gearing our movement? Why are we gearing the movement toward those people who don't care, rather than the large number of people who do care and who just need a clear moral message to follow? I mean, this
we gotta
is,
go to break
this
again,
is,
Gary. Sorry, you
okay.
gotta stay with us.
Real Life Solutions. Voice America Health and Wellness.
The Missing Piece, that's P-E-A-C-E, focuses on the spiritual and compassionate transformation that takes place within when reverence for all life is the focus. We show, through every personal story in no uncertain terms, that an awakening takes place in the love energy of people who refrain from doing harm to any living thing. The stories in The Missing Piece will make you laugh and cry, and we're sure you'll even find little parts of yourself within them, but they will most certainly change your life. You'll see things a little differently for reading them, and we'll find that all of this time, what you've been looking for is right here in The Missing Piece. Take this journey and you won't ever want to turn back. Look for release in the spring of 2009, and to learn more, go to dreamriverpress.com. That's dreamriverpress.com.
The ability to wield power, shape the environment and the outcome, and the desire to make things happen are essential characteristics of all great leaders. Explore the essence of leadership from an insider's point of view on Leadership Intuitions with Dr. Joseph Riggio, international coach, consultant, and advisor to leaders for over 20 years. Get the unvarnished, inside story on how leaders in the spotlight take the critical decisions that deliver exceptional, real-world results and why they sometimes spectacularly and publicly fail as well. Tune into Leadership Intuitions for a behind-the-scenes look at what gets great leaders up in the morning and what keeps them up at night. Go beyond the conventional advice about what great leaders are and what they do, and learn how to create your own personal legacy as a leader. Leadership Intuitions with Dr. Joseph Riggio broadcasts each Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern on the Voice America channel. Leadership Intuitions, power, achievement, relationship.
Income Property Investment Talk with Peter Mosca and Dean Issa provides homeowners and investors eager to invest well in real estate the knowledge, resources, and tools necessary to generate significant wealth. Our focus will be the paradigm. Live where you want. Invest where it makes the most sense. Listen live to the brightest minds in real estate investment every Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel. That's Income Property Investment Talk with Peter Mosca and Dean Issa, where America learns to invest.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Listening to Wake Up America with your host, Tina Volpe. To participate in today's discussion, please call us toll-free in North America at 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You can also comment or question via email at books@fastfoodcraze.com. Now, back to Tina.
Hey, you guys, welcome back. And Gary, welcome back as well. We're talking to Gary Francione. I'm real happy that you're here, Gary. We were talking about welfarism and how it actually really doesn't work.
Yes.
And I'm starting to believe that. I really am, because I think that the bottom line is that these animals are still suffering, tremendously suffering, and they're still being put on a leg chain and being slit, you know, having their neck slit while they're still alive, half of them. And, you know, there's a whole lot of issues that aren't being addressed. But my question to you is, now, if we go your, I mean, if everybody decides that we want to do this this abolishment of any kind of animal exploitation, how are we going to help animals today? I mean, is it going to help animals right now?
Gina, animal welfare ain't helping animals right now. I mean, look at Proposition 2. First of all, it doesn't come into effect until 2015, okay? I mean, most of these animal welfare measures, and the ones that are in effect now, I mean, you know, look at the cage-free egg versus the battery egg. I don't think that the cage-free system is helping hens. I think that cage-free facilities are every bit as brutal and horrible as conventional egg batteries. I think that enriched egg cages, which are coming into, which a number of the European countries are now adopting, I think are every bit as bad as the conventional battery cages. So I don't think that these welfareist measures are doing anything for animals now. Indeed, I think net suffering and death is increasing because people feel more comfortable about animal exploitation, so they consume more animals. And as I said before, we have a lot of people who were previously vegetarian and vegan who are going back to eating animal products because they feel more comfortable, because they're being told by these large organizations that these products are being produced more humanely. So I don't think that these welfare measures, Tina, are at all doing anything for animals now. I think they're actually increasing net suffering and death. What we could do right now, look, the more of us that become vegan, the demand actually drops, and if enough of us become vegan, then we can have a significant effect on animal suffering and death through the decreasing of demand. But your question assumes, and I get this a lot from people who either, you know, promote welfareism or who are on the fence about it. But people are always saying, well, yeah, but you know, if we don't promote welfareism, what can we do right now to help animals? And the answer is, well, welfareism isn't the answer, that's for sure, because that's not helping animals, that's not reducing suffering, that's not making things better, that's making us feel better, but it's not doing anything for the animals. I mean, really, you know, the sort of the silliness involved in all of this is, it would be like, you know, if you were to look at, I mean, most people, or at least I hope most people, except for the present administration of the United States, thinks that waterboarding is torture. Now, you know, it would be like saying, well, let's make sure that the person who's tied to the board, that there's a little bit of padding on the board. You know, so while we're waterboarding them, they're slightly more comfortable while they're tied on the board. I mean, most people would think that that position would be insane. But yet that's the position the animal movement is taking all the time. Is they're busy promoting these largely insignificant, most of the times not even enforceable measures that will supposedly reduce suffering in some absolutely minuscule way, with the result that people feel, hey, things have really significantly improved, so that I, somebody who really cares about animals, I feel comfortable about consuming animals again.
Right, but these welfareists do have, as the bottom line, veganism. They do try to...
Well, you know what? How many millions of years is it going to take to get there if this is the strategy that they're pursuing? If this is the strategy that they're pursuing, I suggest to you, it's a counterproductive strategy. It's never going to get us to abolition. It's never going to get us to veganism. If what we're doing is promoting the consumption of animals, Tina, if we're promoting the consumption of animals and making people feel better about consuming animals, how are we ever going to get to veganism?
That's the way you're putting it. It doesn't feel like we're promoting humane meat. It doesn't feel that way to me. To me, it feels like, and to a lot of people, it feels like we're trying to awaken the public.
But Tina, look for, just take one example. Look at the PETA Kentucky Fried Chicken Canada campaign, where you now have PETA saying, boycott KFC, but don't boycott KFC in Canada, because they're concerned about animal welfare. Now you tell me, I don't know what message you get from that, but the message I get from that, when PETA says don't boycott KFC in Canada because they care about animal welfare,
exactly,
that message is loud and clear in neon lights to me, that there is a morally significant difference between consuming Kentucky Fried Chicken in Canada and consuming Kentucky Fried Chicken in the United States, and that there's a moral difference and that it's okay to do that in Canada. That's the message that comes out. And I think that that's really counterproductive. And let me just say this. When animal welfare emerged as a theory 200 years ago in Britain and then spread to the United States and elsewhere, the theory of animal welfare was that although animals could suffer and we had to be concerned about that, animals didn't care that we killed them and used them. They only cared about how we we killed them and used them. So they didn't care that we took their lives. They only cared about whether we made them suffer. And that is an idea. That idea exists. I mean, you know, the intellectual basis for the present movement is found in the work of Peter Singer. And Peter makes it very, very clear that he does not think that most animals, with the exception of animals like the non-human great apes, that most animals don't have an interest in continuing to live.
Oh, my God.
So he perpetuates this idea.
It's insane. That's insane. We all know that's insane.
Well, but we may all know it's insane, but it's the idea. I mean, it's an idea that Peter Singer very explicitly promotes, and it's an idea that he gets from Jeremy Bentham, who was the 19th century thinker that the utilitarian theorist that basically Singer has modernized for us. But basically the idea that Bentham has and the idea that Singer continues to promote and that Singer says explicitly that most animals don't have a sense of their life. They're animals that live in a continuous present. They don't have thoughts of the future. They don't have concerns about the past. They basically don't have an interest in their lives. As long as you don't make them suffer and you kill them in a relatively painless way, you're not really harming them. Now you can say, hey look, I think that's crazy, but that is the basis of the animal welfare movement. And I really do think, Tina, this is why the idea that the welfarists are promoting is very much this idea that the problem is suffering, it's not killing. That as long as we treat them well, then we're not really harming them if we kill them and we use them.
Well, we have a big word that most people should know and should recognize. It's called karma. And I really believe that killing is wrong, and I don't think we should be killing anything. And so I agree with you as far as how they end up at the slaughterhouse, how they end up there in the transport trucks, all that kind of thing is absolutely agreed with. But I always thought in the back of my head, knowing some of these people, that they were actually trying to do good. And it always felt like, I don't know, it always felt to me like they were really trying to do good. But see, my opinion
I'm not saying that. I mean, I know many of these folks. I mean, I've been doing this now for all of my adult life. I used to be very, very much involved with many of these organizations. I used to work very closely with Ingrid Newkirk and Alex Pacheco at PETA. I worked very, very closely with them for many years. I work with folks from Farm Sanctuary. I work with Wayne Pacell when he used to be with Fund for Animals. I know these folks. I've known them for a long time. I'm not making moral judgments about them. I'm not saying that they're bad people.
That's not the point.
The point is the strategy that they're pursuing is counterproductive and it's wrong.
Well, so we have to go after them. You know, we really do. I think that's where we need to start, Gary.
Is where?
Is with the welfarist groups.
Well, you know, I think in a sense, we ought to let the welfare groups do what the hell they want to do. I think what we need to do is to build another movement. I think we need to build an abolitionist movement founded on a principle of the rejection of violence, a nonviolent movement that is focused on veganism.
I agree. And, we'll pick this up when we come back. You guys stay with us.
A fresh look at today's health. Voice America Health and Wellness.
The missing piece,
that's PEACE,
focuses on the spiritual and compassionate transformation that takes place within when reverence for all life is the focus. We show through every personal story in no uncertain terms that an awakening takes place in the love energy of people who refrain from doing harm to any living thing. The stories in The Missing Piece will make you laugh and cry, and we're sure you'll even find little parts of yourself within them, but they will most certainly change your life. You'll see things a little differently for reading them, and we'll find that all of this time, what you've been looking for is right here in The Missing Piece. Take this journey and you won't ever want to turn back. Look for release in the spring of 2009, and to learn more, go to dreamriverpress.com. That's dreamriverpress.com. Feeling overworked, overwhelmed, Do you feel like you could use a getaway right about now? Have we got a show for you? It's called De-Stress Radio, and this show will help you take control of the stress in your life. Join hosts Robin Siegel and Marin Vertok every week. They'll motivate you to attain balance in both your personal and professional life. You'll want to share each episode with those important to you. Listen for De-Stress Radio with Robin and Marin every Wednesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern on the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Think about your favorite restaurant. How about your favorite night spot? You ever wonder about the secret to their success? Chris Weinberg, CEO of the Barfly Group, will give you a rare peek behind the swinging door into the successful restaurant industry. Everything from business management to culinary trends will be covered. Listen to Hot Burgers and Cold Beer, featuring restaurant consultant Chris Weinberg, every Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Network.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Listening to Wake Up America with your host, Tina Volpe. To participate in today's discussion, please call us toll-free in North America at 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You can also comment or question via email at books@fastfoodcraze.com. Now, back to Tina.
Hey, guys. Welcome back. And welcome back, Gary. We were talking about welfareism, and we were talking about the proper way to change and to stop these animals from suffering. And we're talking about veganism is what we're doing, Gary. Right?
Yeah, I think you know, I think it's sort of a waste of time to constantly be arguing with the welfareists. You're never going to convince HSUS or PETA or these large corporations to really put aside the welfareism and promote abolition. That's not going to happen. And that's fine. Let them do what they want to do, and let them do what they think is appropriate. I think that those of us who care about this issue and want to go in a different direction, we don't really need large organizations. We don't need large, you know, we don't need that sort of structure. It is now possible largely as a result of the Internet, which has made social movement organization possible in ways that never existed before. As a matter of fact, we probably have President-elect Obama's success in large part due to his internet organization. You can do a lot of organizing on the internet and a lot of communication on the internet. And right now, worldwide, an abolitionist movement is building. And it's not just in the U.S., it's in the U.S., it's in Britain, it's in continental Europe, it's in South America. There's an abolitionist movement building based on a simple principle that is veganism is the foundation moral principle and the acceptance of nonviolence as a foundational principle. And I think we really ought to be promoting that. We ought to be educating people. Anna Charlton and I did a very, very simple brochure. We did it in a few hours. And it's now been translated into a bunch of different languages. Other people have come up with very, very good, I believe the Boston Vegetarian Association, BVA, they've come up with a nice brochure. Other people are coming out with literature. It's stuff that you can do, you know, in your home, on the, you know, with your computer. You can come up with some really good educational materials. Get out there and educate people. Because, you know, an afternoon spent at your local community college, an afternoon spent at your local shopping mall, distributing, educating people in a nice, peaceful way about why they shouldn't be exploiting animals. That's a heck of a lot more productive than a lot of this welfareism.
Even having a dinner party, which is what I do. I have
absolutely
incredible, huge vegan dinner parties for all my meat eating friends that live around me here.
Absolutely. We had in one of my classes at the university last semester, I bought one of my students actually her spouse has a restaurant in Brooklyn, has a vegetarian restaurant in Brooklyn, and I had him make a bunch of tofu cheesecakes and brought those into class and gave pieces of tofu cheesecake to these to the students who couldn't believe that they were eating something didn't have any animal products in it.
It's better than the animal products because the animal products leave that greasy taste in that
absolutely But it's very, very important to really sort of get out there and sort of educate people about the fact that, you know, they ought not to be eating animals and that there is really no difference between eating meat and eating dairy. I mean, I meet lots of animal, quote, animal people, end quote, who are not vegans. And this confuses me. They say, well, I'm a vegetarian, but I'm not a vegan. And I always explain to them, look, there's more suffering in a glass of milk than there is in a pound of steak. I mean, you know, the animals, most animals or many animals used for dairy products live longer. They're treated every bit as badly, if not worse. And they all end up in the same slaughterhouse anyway, after which we consume their bodies in any event. So, I mean, to try to draw a distinction between a meat and dairy or eggs or stuff is crazy, and we really ought to make that a very, very clear message. And I'm telling you, I mean, Anna and I started a website a couple of years ago, www.abolitionistapproach.com. It's something that we do and with volunteers. You know, we have people, I mean, we don't have a staff. I don't have an organization. We don't have a 501c3. We just do it. And, you know, we do it with students. We do, you know, we work with students. We work with other people who are interested in helping us out. We have a fine, we have a really wonderful guy, Randy Sandberg, out in California, who's the computer whiz who helps us. He volunteers. And we've now got a website where we're getting a tremendous amount of traffic from all over the world. We have a number of our presentations. We have a mirror site in French. We have a number of our presentations in Spanish, in German, in Dutch. And we're getting, you know, we're getting Chinese worked on. We're getting Japanese worked on. We're getting Turkish worked on. So, you know, we're getting people from all over the globe who are saying, wow, this is a great approach. We want to start this in our local communities. We want grassroots organizations who are educating people about veganism.
And doing no harm. That's the key word to me.
Is what? I'm
do
sorry?
No harm.
Oh, absolutely. No, ahimsa, the principle of nonviolence,
absolutely,
is really what this is all about, because in the end, I mean, the bottom line is we are in the mess we are in because we embrace violence. All forms of injustice, whether it is racism, sexism, heterosexism, or speciesism, these are all forms of violence. They are all related to each other in that they are all violent. And we need to reject them all. And we need to be clear about that. That's yet another reason why I don't really favor a lot of these animal campaigns that focus on sexism. Sexism is a form of violence.
Yes.
Commodifying women is really not a good idea when what you're trying to do is promote the idea that we ought not to commodify non-human animals. So, you know, to say that it's all right to commodify one in order to help educate people about why they ought not to commodify the other is a form of confusion, is a form of moral schizophrenia. So I think it's important, you know, for those of us who care about this issue to sort of say, okay, fine, let the large organizations, they're never going to really change. You're never going to really get them to change. So stop trying to do it. The best thing to do is to put our energy, our time, our energy, our resources into a campaign for nonviolent vegan education, you know, in which we come up with creative ways of educating people about why they ought not to be consuming animals and why they ought to see the consumption of animals as a form of violence that is not morally justifiable. And I think we can make tremendous progress. If you could see the number of responses I get from people all over the world, and I get this, people are constantly writing to me saying, you know, I've never seen the idea expressed this way. It is so simple. It is so clear. You know, people accept it. Does everybody accept it? No. But you know what? There are a lot of people out there who will. So right now, given the state, given where we are right now, let's put our resources into going out there and getting those people that we can convince. And I think we can make a real difference.
I do too, just like they did with slavery. They didn't say, oh, well, we could just keep a few slaves. They abolished slavery.
Exactly. And you know, there was a dispute between, you know, there were people who said, look, you know, we're not going to get rid of slavery tomorrow, so let's make it more humane. And then you had people who said, no, we're not going to support, you know, making slavery more humane because that's going to make it more acceptable. So, you know, you had some people who said, well, you know, let's have rules that say that you can only beat your slave, you know, 10 times a week and not 15 times a week. And then you had people who said, you know, slavery is wrong. And, it, you know, obviously it's better to beat them 10 times a week than 15 times a week, but we shouldn't be beating them at all because we shouldn't have this institution. And I think that that's really how we ought to be thinking about the animal question.
We got to give the website address again for the abolitionist.
It's www.abolitionistapproach.com.
And everybody can go there.
Yes, and yeah, you can go there. And there's all sorts of, you know, they're not only blog essays, but there are video presentations on the theory of animal rights and animals as property, things like that.
We've got to close, you guys. Next week is Karen Davis with UPC. You guys have a wonderful day. Thanks for being with us.
Well, and thank you very much for having me as a guest.
Oh, Gary, we love you. You're the best.
Take care. Thank you very much.
Appreciate you being on.
Bye-bye. Peace to all of you. Take care, everybody.
Take care.
Thank you again for listening. Wake Up America is heard live every Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Be sure to use the information you've learned today over the coming week and the rest of your life. We look forward to having you join us again next weekend.